First things first, I'd like to I'd like to express my appreciation to everybody who came. Yes, the people who are giving the talk do prepare and are going to come anyway, but on a day like this, the fact that you came is very impressive. And I thank each of you for making this big effort and coming out in the cold. My father's a chronographer told me that somebody once came to the Chafetz Chaim and asked him for a bracha that his children should all turn out well. They should all be shomer mitzvos, they should all be people involved in the Torah. And the Chafetz Chaim was taken aback. He said, "You think this can be done with a bracha?" He said, "I'm spending my whole life trying to raise my children well. I'm investing so much effort in trying to be close to them, be warm to them, inculcating them with the Torah of mitzvos. And you think it can be done with a bracha? It can't be done that way. It takes effort. It takes investment. It takes involvement." And when I think about that, what the Chafetz Chaim was saying is, life has many challenges. And you can't think that a bracha will take care of all the challenges. That all you have to do is go to somebody you respect very much, let him give you a bracha, and then your life is taken care of. Jewish life involves maturity. Jewish life involves responsibility. It involves recognizing that we have a lot of challenges, and what we have to do to confront those challenges is not just wait for someone to guide us. We can't entrust our whole life to another person. We can't forget that we're endowed with b'chira chashus, with free will. That Hashem gave each of us seichel, Hashem gave each of us a good mind, and we have to use that mind. In fact, the Rambam says in Hilchos Tshuva, let's just see if it's down here. Perekei, Halakha Aleph. He says, "Rishut b'chol adam nusniya, im ratzah lahatzos atzmo l'dar tova, v'liyot tzadik, harishus b'yado." Source number four, everyone has permission. Everyone has the possibility. If he wants to turn himself to a good path and to become a tzadik, to become a righteous person. If a person wants to go in a negative way, in an evil way, he can become that kind of person. That's why it's written in Torah. Hashem says about Adam HaRishon, that man is trying to become like Hashem, to know good or bad. Klomar, what it's saying is, min zesh adam hayelchid ba'olam, that this type, this category called adam, called mankind, is unique in the world. Ve'ein min sheni domelo b'zeh en yam, there is no other kind of creature similar to man in this particular way. Sheyehehu me'atzmo v'dato v'machshavto yodea hato v'hara, that he, from his own understanding, from his own knowledge, can tell the difference between good and bad. And then the Rambam goes on to say, how he behaves as a result, and behaves himself accordingly. So we're told very clearly that it's up to each of us what kind of life we would like to lead, and it's not only to go and ask someone else, well, what should I do? And the Rambam goes on to say, Hilchos Tshuva, Perekei, Tshuva Zalim, number 5. If it really was outside of a person's will, if it was a tzera, if it was a decree, whether a person would be righteous or evil, or if it was something that would absolutely pull a person from birth to be going in one way or to be following one kind of belief or another, or be doing one kind of deeds or another, k'mo shebodin milibam hatibshim O Great Shemayim, as people who are foolish believe in astrology, and the Rambam is very clear, nothing forces you to be a certain way. And whenever I see the horoscope in the newspaper, I just quickly turn the page, because that is so far from Jewish belief. We don't believe that you have a nature that was put into you, that you're supposed to be angry or impulsive or anything else like that. It's very much up to you to develop yourself. And it's interesting because my grandson commented, this is just a side thing, not part of the year, but he commented on his younger brother, who once used to have a terrible temper. And he said, look at him now. He's a teenager, and he's such a serene person. He's such a calm person. And his grandparents, my husband and I, when we heard this comment from him, we thought to ourselves, first of all, this is a result of very good raising. He has parents who were very calm and helped him through getting through the times of being such an angry little kid. And then he himself decided that what was all the rage about and what was all the fury about. And he himself cultivated becoming a calm, he was always a kind person, but becoming a more calm person. So you can actually see it happening in front of you, how a child may start in one way, and with good raising and good understanding on his own part, develop another way. So we really don't have the excuse in Jewish life to say, it's the stars that did it, or my horoscope tells me this is the way I have to be. It's up to us to decide what we want to be. And the Rambam warns us against trying to look for signs, trying to look for superstitious beliefs that will tell us something about ourselves. And in fact, Rav Shachet Subato, who's Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshivat Yitzchok Yosef in Tel Yericho in Israel, warned his students against having a certain kind of fearfulness, a certain kind of credulousness, a certain kind of trying to believe too quickly in another person, either telling them what to do or telling them the meanings of things. He counseled his students very much to use their own understanding. And the pesukim that he used were from Dvarim, Dvarim Yochet, Pasuk Aleph. And where do we have that here? We have them down. No, this is why I had asked Rabbi Sharka to give me the Makoros ahead of time to make sure that they were all down. I'll just say what it says in Dvarim Yochet, Pasuk Yud and Yud Aleph. We should not have among ourselves people who are Kosein Mitzamim, people who use divination, a person who's an Onay, a person who's a soothsayer, a person who's an Achesh, a person who's an enchanter, a person who's a Kashev, who's a witch, a person who's Chaver Chavar, Chaver, a person who's a charmer, a person who's Doresh O and Yidomi, who looks to a medium or a wizard, or a person who's Doresh Lahamesid, a person who's a necromancer, who says that he can summon the dead. What are all of these indicating? They're all things that are not rational. They're all things that are relying on a kind of magical, unique power that another person has. And we are not allowed to believe in that. In fact, what Rav Sabato said was that a person who says he has unique powers, you know automatically that person is a fraud. He said, nobody today has such special knowledge of Hashem's will and what Hashem plans that he can tell you at a time that he has Ruach Hashem. That's a very dangerous thing for a person to say about himself. And Rav Sabato gave us the example, unfortunately, a year ago summer, when we were all hoping that those three boys would be found, who unfortunately had been murdered immediately. There were people who actually said, don't worry, they know Ruach Hashem, the boys will be found alive, everything will be okay. Then Nebuch, when we found out that they had been murdered, these Kedoshim, those people were nowhere to be heard. Where were their predictions that the boys were going to be found alive? And Rav Sabato said, this should be some kind of lesson to us, not to even listen to anybody who says he has Ruach Hashem. Or Rav Sabato said, people who say they know Kabbalah. Rav Sabato said, absolutely, nobody in this time knows Kabbalah. And he said, anybody who tells you that he's a Kabbalist and gives his proof, for example, that he can tell you how many children you have and what their names are. Rav Sabato doesn't say outright the word fraud. He just says there are also other people who know how to do this particular thing and how to tell you how many children you have and what their names are. You realize this person who said this kind of thing always has an assistant, but somehow gotten that knowledge before the supposed Kabbalist meets with you. Nobody knows the Kabbalah, how many children you have, and what their names are. And he says to be very wary of this kind of thing. I would say the thing to be wary of is if you hear that a person has charisma. Because what does charisma mean? I looked up the word charisma, and what it means, in Christian theology, it means a person who is divinely inspired with a certain talent. And it has come to mean, aside from Christian theology, in daily conversation, it's a special quality that captures the popular imagination and inspires unwavering allegiance. And when you hear of all the unfortunate scandals that have happened in the last decade, of youngsters being misled, of people being preyed upon, again and again, how is the person who did the evil deed to these children, or to these young women, or to these young men, how is the person always described? He was charismatic. He overwhelmed them with the quality of his personality. You have to be very careful. Charisma is not a Jewish quality. And it's not something that we look to be overwhelmed that way. We're supposed to use our sefer and not to hand over our life to another person. To decide for ourselves, to use our bechira. In fact, the function of a rav or a teacher is never to decide for you. It's to talk through the implications of a decision with you. And then you make the decision. And I'll give you three examples from real life. Rav Avraham Yaakov Kahn, Zichrono Livracha, who was a Rosh Yeshiva in Tzfar Vazah, was once asked by a young man what he should do. He was going out with a young woman, and it was the first time he had ever gone out. And he was so impressed with her. It was delightful to talk with her. They had shared values. They were looking to a similar future. Everything seemed wonderful. What was the problem? She had already gone out with many people. In fact, she had kept a list when it started becoming a lot of people. He was the 60th young man that she had gone out with. And for him, this was the first time he had ever gone out. And yet he felt immediately, this is the young woman he wants to marry. And she obviously was feeling the same way about him. So he went to his Rosh Yeshiva, and he said, what do I do? So Rav Kahn talked it through with him. And he said, well, there are two ways to look at this. One way to look at it is, you don't know what you're doing. You've never gone out before. This is the first young woman you've ever gone out with. And you may be overwhelmed with the novelty of it. So you're right. You probably should go take one or two other people and explain to her. You're doing this because you want to make sure of what you're doing. And Rav Kahn said, the other way to look at it is, what a favor Hashem has done you. You immediately found the right person. What a bracha. You don't have to call and find out, does she want to go out again? Does she not want to go out again? You don't have to check, is it going well? Is it not going well? Immediately it's going well. So the young man said in his Rosh Hashanah, so which one do I choose? Rav Kahn said, that's up to you. He chose very well, Baruch Hashem. They have grandchildren, thank God. But Rav Kahn was getting an important lesson, of course, to him. I can talk it through with you, but I can't decide for you. The same thing happened, I heard this from Rabbi Breidowitz when he gave a talk, in fact, at Karen's husband's shul. And he mentioned that when he was considering whether to go to Harvard Law School or not, he went to talk with the Rosh Hashiva at his time, at Tzfar Das, he went to talk with Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and to talk through with him, should I now go to law school? I mean, after it was so tempting, Harvard Law School, that was a wonderful thing that he'd been accepted, should he go or not? He said he spoke with Rav Kamenetsky for 2.5 hours. They talked to everything, through everything. What his goals in life were. What was going to happen to his Torah learning? Was he going to be able to continue learning Torah while he would be in law school? They talked through everything. After 2.5 hours, they had analyzed the situation thoroughly. Rabbi Breitwitz left Rav Kamenetsky's office and still did not have a clear indication for Rav Kamenetsky what he should do. But he said he certainly had a clear knowledge of what the alternatives were, and if he's making his decision, what some of the things were to consider. And he looked back on that with such appreciation for the fact that his Rosh Yeshiva trusted him to be an adult, a mensch, who could decide, but wanted to see things through with somebody who was so wise What both implications were of the decision either way. I'm sure he made Rabbi Breitholtz's mother very happy that he decided to go to law school. But he had to talk it through properly and think it through properly. I went to Rabbi Salvation, when Yosef Dov Salvation, in 1981. I was the principal of a girls' high school. At that time, it was just beginning to be the whole recommendation of career versus home and where a woman should be. It's interesting. This was only a problem after about 50 years of urbanization and industrialization. Because the truth is, when we used to live outside of big cities, every home was a kind of farm in itself. Everyone had chickens, everyone had cows in order to have milk, everyone had a vegetable garden and fruit trees. It was only when we became an urban, industrialized people, not just Jewish people, everybody, but it happened in Western countries where many of us were, that it became possible for the woman to be at home and the husband to be at work in an office or a factory or wherever it might be. And then things reversed, and in the 1950s, 1960s, women became interested in working outside the home. I won't go into all the reasons for this. I don't have either a feminist or anti-feminist ideology. It happened. That's what happened. And I wanted to hear from him which way I should be encouraging young women. He said, it's shnei sedim hamachishim zed zed. And for that, I have the advice of Rabbi Shmuel. I put it at the top. Yes. Rabbi Shmuel, this is why I wanted to see the source sheet ahead of time. I said not to put in the first number of different ways that Rabbi Shmuel gives us the midot that we interpret the Torah. I only really need the last one. Okay, shnei ksuvim hamachishim zed zed. Two texts that contradict each other. Ad sheyavo hakasuv hashlishi yafri yameinim. You come to a third text in the Torah that decides the matter for you. So that means that you have a text that seems to say one way, and you have a text that seems to say another way. You come to a third text that resolves the question. That's one of the ways that Rabbi Shmuel advises interpreting the Torah. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, one text here is the woman herself. She would like to be out in the world. She'd like to be earning a paycheck. We all know that a paycheck is a very fine thing. I think all of us can remember our first paycheck and what an excitement that was when we actually earned money. And making a name for herself. So there's a desire to be out there in the world. And on the other hand, there's a desire to raise your own child. You want to hear the first word. You want to see the first step. You want to be there. You don't know if anybody else is going to give the love to this. Nobody else can give the love to the child that the mother can give. And you want to be the one who's there for that purpose. He said, what's the custom hashlishi shiach v'yivayneihem? It's the woman herself. And here's the way he explained it. He said, if a woman's out in the world, being whatever profession she chooses, if she's a lawyer, if she's a psychologist, if she's an accountant, whatever she chooses to be, and she's there in the office thinking to herself, I'm solving other people's legal problems. I'm solving other people's emotional problems. But what am I doing to my child at home? That I'm meeting him every morning and saying there's much more important things in the world to me than taking care of you and going off for the day. So if she's sitting there worrying about what she's doing to her own child, that's not a healthy thing to do. He said, on the other hand, if the woman is at home and she's resenting the fact, I am stuck here at home changing diapers, I don't talk to another adult for most of the day, when is this ever going to resolve itself? When will this child already be a nursery and I can go out and do things in the world? He said, the child will feel the resentment. That's not healthy either. He said, what's the custom hashlishi yivayneihem? It's the woman herself. A woman has to analyze herself, what is important to her at this moment. He said, she doesn't have to make a big announcement, I'm a career woman. She doesn't have to make a big announcement, I'm a homemaker. And simply, I learned that expression from my mother. She never allowed us to write on profession for our mother, housewife. She said, I'm not the wife of a house. I'm the maker of a home. So we always had to write homemaker from another profession. And he said, she has decided herself that she doesn't even have to announce to the world once and forever, I'm a career woman or I'm a homemaker. He said, at every juncture, the woman has to realize what will be healthy for her and her family. And if she feels she wants to stay home, let her stay home and take care of her child. And anybody who says staying home does not work has never stayed home. Let her decide for herself whether she wants to stay home and take care of her children. Or if she wants to go out in the world, do whatever she wants to do, let her decide. As long as she has responsible, you put this point this out, as long as she has responsible, good care for her children, not to feel that she's giving her child over to somebody who might have to show her, mistreat the child, or might not pay proper attention to the child. But he said, at every juncture, she can decide again. There might be times when she wants to work part-time and stay home most of the time. There might be times the opposite, when she wants to work full-time and only be home in the evenings on weekends. But he said, the woman has to decide herself. And as long as she decides responsibly, it's just fine. As long as she knows her children are in good care, it's just fine. And he said, just remind the young women in high school now that life expectancy, this was 1981, so life expectancy for women then was approaching 80. Now life expectancy for women, I think it's already 81 or 82. Mr. Chen, we should all live to 120. The life expectancy for women has definitely advanced. And he said, nobody is having children past a certain stage in life. So even if it seems like the diapers will never end, and the laundry will never stop, and all the rest of this will be going on, there will come a point when your house is empty. And when you have plenty of time to do, thank you very much, when you have plenty of time to do whatever you want to do and to pursue whatever you want to pursue. I will not be unrealistic and say you can go to medical school when you're 50. I don't think you'll find a medical school in the United States that will quickly accept you at 50, because they will feel they're investing in someone who won't use the training that long. But there are many other fields where not only will you be accepted, but you'll be welcomed. For example, psychology, sociology, social work, all the fields that involve interaction with people, you are so much more ready to deal well with people when you're 50 and 60 than you were when you were 20. You've learned from experience, you've been bruised by life, as we all are, but you've recovered, as I hope we all do, and you're much more understanding to what other people are going through, since you've been through one or two challenges yourself. So he said, this is added on my part, this is not what Ralph Alvager said about these different professions. But he said, let them remember that it's time, that Hashem is giving a good life span to women, and there'll be time to do a lot of things that you may not be able to do when you're raising little children. And then he added with a smile, because he understood people so well. He said, but tell the girls they should decide, not their husband, not their mother, and not their mother-in-law. And I thought that was just brilliant. And I've told that to many young women, and what's interesting to me is when I've repeated this to women who are already well into their decisions, even women who are, thank God, in their 60s and 70s, they've told me afterward, it reassured them so much. They made decisions based on what they thought was good for their family, and it justified to them. They don't have to answer to anybody. I didn't become a lawyer, I didn't become this, I didn't become that. I did what I thought I wanted to do, what I had to do. And that's exactly what Rav Salvation was recommending, doing it responsibly. And in fact, he gave excellent advice, which I heard from my husband, when a student came to me. She was at Stern College. Her parents only wanted her to major in computers, which had just become very much the new topic to be studied. And she wanted to go into chinuch. She wanted to major in Jewish studies. And her parents were very concerned, because we all know that chinuch is a very challenging kind of field to enter, and it's not where you're going to get a lot of money. On the other hand, computers seem to be a way toward a financially secure future. And she is a brilliant young woman, and she's such a good kid. She didn't want to go against her parents, but she didn't want to major in computer science. She wanted to major in Jewish studies. And she came to talk to my husband and me. She had been my student in high school, so she came to our apartment. My husband was part of the discussion. So he said, Rafael Major used to say that when you're faced with a decision and you really have a dilemma what to do, write down on a piece of paper all the pluses and minuses of a decision one way, and on the other side, all the pluses and minuses of the decision the other way. And when you look at your own reasons and your own analysis, the answer will be there for you. So she went home, and she called the next day, and she said, here's what I wrote down for the Big College. I wrote down, fascinating, important, the purpose of living, the purpose of being a Jew, all the wonderful things that teaching would be after the fulfillment of all her dreams. She had lots of things to write down for Lumi Dakodesh. That's what was the plus on the Lumi Dakodesh side. The only minus was financial insecurity, which is true. That was the minus of Tina. On the other side, she looked at computer science. What was the one thing she had to say about computer science? One word: boring. So she said, she called her parents and she said, "I want to tell you honestly what my feeling is." She told them about the Rafael experiment and how to make a decision that she had done. And her parents, being very loving, understanding parents, said, "We're not going to force you to do something you really do not love doing. Go ahead, make your music focus." She's now the principal of Yeshiva High School. She is doing brilliant work in the field. And I am so glad that she followed Russell Mason's advice, but followed in a very intelligent way, sharing with her parents what she was doing and explaining her reasoning. Okay, let's look at what the Makoros teach us about using one's own reasoning. I'm going to see in a minute. Well, the first thing is, okay, number two, it's up to us. If we want good things to come our way, if we want to have a good life, it's up to us to choose to fear Hashem and to follow all the mitzvahs. And this comes in the summation of what happened to us after getting out of Sarah said the rose. This is what Hashem expected of us, that we should choose the kind of life we're going to lead and a life of Shemaras Mitzvahs. We also have it in 7. I only put the first pasuk down here, but the psukim are all about Hashem giving us bracha uklala. We're given either blessing or curse, and it's up to us. Hashem left it up to us. Before us is life and good, or death and evil. And it's up to us to choose which way we're going to live our lives. And Hashem has given us the wherewithal, the seichel, and we have to follow through with that seichel and make the choices that we do. We have to be very careful not to be misled, and to watch out for people who will try to fool us. So, for example, in source number 6, in the Rambam, Hilchos Avodah Zarah, we're told, "Ein menachashim ta'akum, v'odei kochavim menachalos, shemar lo tenachashu." We were told not to try to do things through any kind of magical interpretation thing. Ketzad hu hanachash, what kind of magical things are we talking about? Even Kugon Eluch Omin Ho'il Laflav T.E.P. Al Mafal Makli Miyadai, Eni Holech Lakom Kloni Hayom, Shit Melech, Ein Chapatzai Nasim. We are so far away from superstition in Jewish life, and we are so far away from magical thinking in Jewish life, that the Rambam says, we don't even say, "Oh, my piece of bread or my piece of food fell out of my hand this morning." Or we don't say, my walking stick fell out of my hand. I'm not going to go to this particular place today because nothing will succeed. It's taken as a bad omen that I dropped something or that my stick fell. Ho'il ba'avar shu'al mimimi, or what can I do? A fox passed near me. Any of the things have to say, see how young she may say, you say any rama'ai. Again, it's not the whole thing, but it's okay. And not to say that, I saw an evil sign, and I can't go out, I can't do anything, everything will not work out today. Now, that's not to say that you can't figure out how you're feeling about things, or if something makes you nervous, or concerned, or fearful, but you can't govern your life with superstition. You can't always be looking for signs or omens to determine what you do. You have to rationally think to yourself, what does it mean that I dropped a piece of bread? And of course, we all know that a piece of bread always falls off the butter side. Yes, okay. It doesn't mean anything. It means that sometimes that happens, that you drop a piece of bread. Or sometimes it happens that the person is using a cane or an umbrella or whatever it might be to support himself. It might fall. But it doesn't mean that you can't do anything that day. It doesn't mean that you better just stay home because that was a sign not to do anything. If something makes you feel good, if the sun is out and that makes you feel happy, do not analyze yourself, that makes me happy. But it doesn't mean that you'll only go out if the sun is out. Or as you prove today, that you'll say, well, the cold was a sign I shouldn't go out for a year. You make your own decision in your own rational way, and that's how you do things. And you have to watch out for people who are going to try to do tricks in any way. You have to ask yourself, is this an appropriate interpretation of what's happening? And is this the way that I should conduct myself as a result? And Rambam points out later in this source that we cannot criticize Eliezer for what he did. Because when Eliezer was saying, I want this sign that the young woman should do such and such, what did he give as an example? He wanted a sign of kindness. He was saying, well, be the kind of woman who says, here, you drink, and I'll give you camels to drink. But he wasn't looking for some kind of magical, superstitious indication that this is the woman. It's just that he was trying to say an example of what he was hoping to find in the young woman who would be appropriate for Yitzhak. Then the Rambam tells us, Halochesh al Hamakba, the Korei Pusuk in Hatorah, this is source number 7. If somebody whispers over a wound and says some magical thing, the Korei Pusuk in Hatorah and says a Pusuk in the Torah, the Chen HaKorei HaMinok Shalivash, or says something over the, says some kind of Pusuk, so the little baby should not startle, should not be frightened. A person who puts a sefer Torah or a pair of tefillin on little ones so you should fall asleep. It's not enough that they're doing these superstitious things they shouldn't be doing. They're doing these kinds of astrological things or mythical things. But they are actually kofim b'Torah. They're in some way really behaving incorrectly according to the Torah. She'ino sin yibrei Torah refuas eikov, refuas zov. They're thinking that words of Torah can heal the body. Ve'einam el refuas nefashos, shnevar b'yiyu chayim l'nashecha. The Torah is for our inner essence, for our nefesh, which we interpret soul, that's where we translate it. That means the essence of the person. And that's where the Torah brings life. Aval habarim shekrab sukim nizmar betilim kidei shekenu av sikus piyasam yitem yitzros ubin yitzakim kreze mutar. But if a person is healthy and he reads sukim in the Torah, or he reads nizmar betilim, because he wants to just have the sikus, the merit of having studied Torah or having read tehillim, and he hopes that that should help him keep away from any kind of sorrows, that Rambam says is mutar. That's permitted. Now, why do you think Rambam makes that distinction? That you can't take a sefer Torah, or you can't take your pair of tefillin, and put them on a person, and say, this should do something for the person, and yet he says it's okay to learn Torah, or to say tehillim, and hope that this will have a good effect. What's the difference between the two? Why is the Rambam making that distinction? What would he say? Exactly. The first one is more magical. It's saying that somehow the object, the sefer Torah itself, is going to do magic, or the tefillin is going to do magic. The second one, you're saying, I am learning because I hope that this will be a zechus, that this will be a merit. I'm saying tehillim because I hope that this will be a zechus, that will be a merit. And in that way, you can do what you're doing. You're doing something that's not a physical object, that's not material. You're doing something that involves your mind and your appreciation of Hashem. What's Tehillim all about? Tehillim is all about an appreciation of Hashem. Tehillim is all about praise of Hashem. Learning Torah is all about a relationship with Hashem. That you can take as a zechus, as merit. But you don't take a physical thing and hope that it will be a charm and work the magic that you're looking for to happen. The mitzvah tefillin is zechus, but not to put a pair of tefillin on a baby and hope that will make the baby fall asleep. Not to put a sefer Torah on a sick person and think that the sefer Torah is going to heal the sick person. Instead, say tehillim. Instead, learn Torah. But don't do a physical object and think that it has magical qualities. We're not superstitious. Yes?
Don't you think we fall into giving magical qualities to Shechem as well. In other words, if our intention, if we daven for a purpose, for refuah or something, or saying Tehillim, if we're doing it because we really think that we're going to influence the decision of the Kaddish Baruch Hu, it becomes a little magical too.
But
and when it doesn't happen, the devastation the Kaddish Baruch Hu didn't listen to us, as opposed to an intention that we're doing the only thing we can do, but we know we're powerless.
You said it exactly. She said, are we really trying to influence Hashem when we daven? Is that a little bit of magical thinking that's going on there? Or what was the second part you said? Or are we just hoping it's a sukkos that we're providing?
Or we daven because we really understand we're totally powerless, and it's the only thing we can do, so we
perfect.
Can, but not with the idea that the outcome has to be what we think.
Exactly. When you daven, you're trying to do whatever a person can do in this situation, but you don't think that you are going to be the reason that Hashem is going to make that person get better. What you're trying to do is add a recognition in your understanding of the world, Hashem, you're in charge. Everything that's going to happen is a reason for it. You have your reasons. We human beings do not always understand the reasons, and we can't always fathom why things happen the way they do. But what we're saying when we daven is, ultimately, this is where the control of the world is. Ultimately, this is both the Bore Olam and the Manhig Olamo, the one who is conducting this world. And we're just asking a request to Hashem, please Hashem, please let this person be here. What would you say? I have to tell you two things. One is, it's just an expression of a tefillah. The person's actually just writing out a tefillah when he puts a petek in the kotel. When a person puts a little note in the kotel asking Hashem for certain things, it's not going to happen magically that there's going to be peace between Israel and its neighbors because you put that petek into the kotel. You're just saying, this is my tefillah at this moment, and you're writing down that tefillah. In fact, it's interesting that you asked about the kotel because I was thinking about that. Tehillah and I were outside listening to Rav Schachter speak. We didn't want to walk in because everybody turns around when someone walks in and turns away from the speaker. But I was thinking about when he was talking about different things with Kedusha and the Kotel. About 14 years ago, I had to meet Rav Michal Feinstein, Zichron Levracha, and his wife, Rav Tzilisha Feinstein. She was the daughter of the Brisker Rav. She was a Soloveitchik chick originally. And Rav Michal Feinstein was a relative of Moshe Feinstein. I don't remember if he was a cousin or a nephew, but he was a close relative of Moshe Feinstein. Tremendous Talmid Chacham, known within the world of learning, within the world of lomdos, but not known in the popular world. We have a number of people like that who don't get a big name, but are remarkable people. And I wanted to interview them when I was writing the biography of my father, because I knew there had been a close friendship between Rob and Revson Feinstein and my parents. They actually stayed at our house for a month after World War II. And I asked where I could interview them. So Revson Feinstein said, we're coming in from Bnei Brak to Yerushalayim today, and we'll meet you at the Kotel. I said, oh, at the Kotel itself? She said, oh no, Rob Feinstein doesn't go there because he feels that we don't know exactly to where the Kedusha extends, and he doesn't want to accidentally step on a place where nobody should be stepping. So she said, we never go up to the Kotel. We go to the very back of the plaza, and that's where we daven from. That's where we say Tehillim from when we come to the Kotel. So I went to the very back of the plaza at the time appointed, and I met them there. And to me, it was such a lesson, because when I read today about people who dare to say that they want to go up in the Har HaBayis, they really should have consulted with somebody like Rav Michal Feinstein, who would tell them, who gave you permission to put your foot on the Har HaBayis? Rav Michal Feinstein, who would not even go near the Kotel, lest he be going into a place of too great Kedusha. So I'm sure that he and his Rebbetzin did not put a petek into the Kotel, but I'm sure that back there at the back of the plaza, their tefillos for Am Yisrael, for Eretz Yisrael, were very heartfelt, and that's what we can do. We can offer our tefillos, but we're not thinking superstitiously they're going to work a magical effect. In fact, the tefillos have two effects. We hope that Hashem will listen to our requests and that Hashem will hear that we are turning to Him as the Manhig Olamo. But it's also having an effect on us because we are realizing there's so much that's not in our control. And we have to work the best we can with whatever we can. I would say at the end of it all, you have to be very careful about people who say they have magical powers. In fact, I looked up something after I saw an ad in the Jewish press for someone who's coming to the United States and was going to pour lead into water, molten lead into water, and was going to tell you, based on the shapes, something about your future. And I looked up pouring lead on the internet, and I found out that it was a pagan Greek ritual from many, many centuries ago, and it was picked up in Nordic countries. And at the new year, in certain Nordic countries, Finland, Sweden, Norway, those countries, that's a little ritual that they have, and it's for the Christian new year, that they melt a metal, lead is too expensive, so they melt tin now, and they pour the tin into cold water, they see the shape that it takes, and then on the internet, I learned what the different shapes mean. One shape means success in this, another shape means success in that, and that's how they're judged. And I thought to myself, how is it that somebody's coming from Israel and pouring lead into water, and people are accepting that? If they would even look up where it comes from, they would be shocked. It's not Jewish. It's not Jewish to do things like that. So I would say that you have to be very careful. Use your own good mind. Use your own good understanding. And use what you have learned from the Torah, that we don't pay attention to Nichush and Kshafim and to all these kinds of superstitious things, and turn the horoscope page in the newspaper immediately, because that's not ours. That's not for us. It's not Jewish, all the belief in predetermined things. And recognizing something that Rabbi Matthias Greenblatt once said to me, quoting what he had heard at the yeshiva at Yeshiva Shebeinu Chai in Berlin, Ruba de Ruba, the Ribon Shalom, Yerd Sein Welt. For most of the time, you can tell the Ribon Shalom is conducting his world. You can trust Hashem has reasons. There's reasons that things happen. There are reasons that challenges come into our lives, and we have to act accordingly. And I would say, finally, if you see something you think is inappropriate, question it. Don't just follow the leader. Ask yourself, why are people doing this? Why are people paying attention to this? I was raised with the notion that everybody says, or everyone knows. My parents immediately ask, well, who is everybody? Who is everyone? Why are you listening to something because you think other people are saying it? Use your own good mind to analyze. Could this be true? Could this be a valid Torah way? And I know from writing the book myself, when I did a Hebrew version of the book, a Hebrew translation of biography that I wrote to my father, I made 3 corrections. Things where I had assumed something and I was wrong. To give you an example, one correction. It's tiny, but it says something. I always heard about Rabbah, where my grandmother's father had been the Rav, and from all the stories I heard, I always assumed it was in Latvia, because my family came from Latvia. After my English book was published, I didn't think of this ahead of time. I went to look up Rabbah. It was Lithuania, not Latvia. Now, it sounds very minor, but I corrected that when I wrote the Hebrew version. I didn't write it by myself, I translated together with somebody's help. Today, I opened Hamodia, which a guest left in our house, a guest for Shabbos. She said, here, you read it now, I read it on Shabbos. I opened the first page, and there they list the history of Hamodia. And I know that my father's uncle founded Hamodia in Poltava, Russia, over 100 years ago. And there, on the editorial page of Hamodia, it says, founder, Rabbi Eliyahu Akiva Rabinovich, my father's uncle, Poltava, Poland. My uncle was never a rabbi in Poland. He was a rabbi in Poltava, Russia. And it's a very significant thing, because in Russia, he was considered the young rabbi who was saying such revolutionary things as we have to have a magazine in Hebrew that will be in a beautiful, perfect Hebrew, because the Hebraists at the time, who were part of the Haskalah movement, were criticizing any Jew who was a Masorah Jew, who was following our proper heritage, and say they can't even write Hebrew. They can't even, they're so behind the times. All they know is Tanakh. They don't know. So he, Badaka, founded a journal called Papeles in 1906 to show monthly beautiful essays written in beautiful Hebrew, to show, yes, you can be a Torah Jew and you can write Hebrew on events of the time. And then when he saw that a weekly was needed, that's when he founded Hamotia. And He is the one who saved my father's family. They were in Latvia, and during World War I, the rabbi in each small town was being taken for a hostage. The Germans, so that the Jewish community should not help the Russians, or the Russians, so the Jewish community should not help the Germans. But either way, whichever group got to that town first, they took the rabbi as a hostage to hold the Jewish community responsible, not to help the enemy. And that same founder of Hamotia in Poltava, Russia, heard about this, telegraphed to my grandfather to say, leave town immediately. My grandfather was in a place called Subot, Latvia. He said, I heard that rabbis are being arrested either way, one side or the other. Come to Poltava immediately. My grandparents left that day with 10 children, and they went to Poltava in Russia. And afterward, they found out from people in the community that soldiers had come to arrest my grandfather that night. If his brother had not alerted him and gotten him out of Subot, out of Latvia, we wouldn't be here. So I know that Poltava is in Russia, and I know that that's where my grandfather's family went. And then to see Poltava, Poland, so question what you read. Whatever you read, just make sure that it's accurate. I'll tell you, I said an inaccuracy by saying that Bogomo was in Latvia, wasn't in Lithuania, and now I see that Hamotia put Poltava into Poland instead of into Russia. It's tiny, but it's significant that you have to question everything you read. And of course, question everything you hear. And ultimately, use your own good seichel that Hashem gave you, and learn as much Torah as you can, so you can have the wherewithal to encounter all the challenges of life. Thank you. Thank you.